Just before you listen to today's episode, this is a quick message to remind you that if you like what you hear, you can help support History Hack, which is run entirely by volunteers using our Patreon account. There are links on all of our episodes. Or if a subscription is not your thing, you can also now drop us a line on Ko-fi, which is just the equivalent of buying us a drink. So if you hear an episode, you like it, and you want to chip in just once, then you can do that too. Thank you. Hello and welcome to another instalment of History Hack. I'm here with Zach, who's been scheming. Zach,
yes, yes, I have. So we decided to keep you in the dark on this one, boss.
Yeah, I have no clue what's going on. To be fair, there's plenty of podcasts where I've got no idea what's going on, but this more so.
Well, you sent me off with a brief, which was go and find something to bash Mel Gibson and Apocalypto with. Ooh, and yes. I basically ignored that brief, but stuck with the whole kind of Mayer and Apocalypse thing. And folks will remember that a while back we had Matthew Restall on for a brilliant and really enlightening episode on the Aztecs that left myself and Alex, you know, with gobs.
Ruined like our childhood, basically.
I mean, at the end of it, I was trying to catch
we had Miles. About brutal human sacrifices and people ripping each other's still beating hearts out, and he told us it was all rubbish.
Pretty much. So Matthew is back in his capacity as Professor of History, Anthropology and Women's Studies and Director of Latin American Studies at Pennsylvania State University. But we're also joined by Amara Solari, Professor of Art History and Anthropology and Director of Graduate Studies in Art History at, wait for it, Pennsylvania State University. They are a husband.
The plot thickens.
Yeah.
The plot thickens. They are a husband and wife duo. So the reason that we brought them together isn't just that they've worked on a number of books connected with the Maya, including The Maya, A Very Short Introduction, and have a forthcoming joint book, The Maya Apocalypse and Its Western Roots. So that keeps Alex happy, so I'm off the hook there. But Matthew tells me that there are areas where they basically disagree with each other. So what I'm basically trying to set up here is us having the first ever domestic on History Hack.
Is this live why you've got popcorn?
On a recording. Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
You really are a sneaky git, aren't you?
I'm evil. I'm yeah, evil. Everybody just
trying
thinks.
To fight divorce proceedings or something. I'm not quite sure.
How are you guys?
Good, good. It's nice to be back, Alex and Zach. Thank you for having me back. I'm surprised you had me back. I'm sure that Aztec show is probably what the lowest rated.
Oh my God, it's not. Done,
right? Absolutely. It's the bottom of the, no.
No.
And you know, I feel like I misled you about the disagreement. We actually only disagree about who takes the rubbish out. And who folds the
you
laundry.
You say that, but you
we
just said
you completely agree on everything to do with the Maya.
Well, she's shaking her head, and you also said we pretty much agree about me being right, and she was fiercely shaking her head. So I don't think Amara necessarily, she doesn't even agree with you about how much you agree on. So I think your perceptions might be slightly different.
Like right. Most husbands, yeah.
When I was going to say, this is like a man else, thing, yes. Isn't it? That the men... Exactly. The men think that they're in charge, and just the reality
we just
is
let
that...
them until they exactly. overstep, and then we... swap them back in their place, basically.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to mansplain. I'll mansplain the Maya for the next hour. How's that? You actually yeah. call it that? Mansplain the Maya.
That'll go down so
it
well.
It is true. He will do that. Fun fact, early in our relationship, I had a very nerdy academic question for him about this particular Maya lineage. And his response, the first words out of his mouth were, well, you see, the Yucatan Peninsula is a limestone shelf that jets into the Caribbean Ocean. And I just thought, I don't think I'm going to go on date number four with this.
I know. I think you thought, well,
I do have a PhD in this subject.
That's
as
an
well.
Apocryphal story, by the
it
way.
Is not. It that is absolutely.
You know what we should do?
It's completely made up.
We should have a podcast at some point about how he managed to claw it back so you married him, because that would
be a long podcast. It'd be like multiple series of that.
Let's
you know
do this.
Is by being publicly humiliated because she repeats that story over and over.
Oh, just
she's done
friends.
It for, you know, in when we're giving lectures and there's, you know, whatever, a few hundred people in the room, and she'll tell that story. And then they'll all look at me like, what a Are we allowed to say douchebag on that?
Yeah, dick, anything. Yeah.
Oh, awesome. There's no rules. Excellent. That's right. I remember.
No, there's no rules. Frankly, if we get to the end of a podcast without a knob joke, we start calling ourselves Radio 4. Let's set the context for our listeners as quickly. Zach's put in his notes, as quickly as we can, so that you can get to the bit where you fight with each other. He's such a stirrer. Right, let's set the context. Who are, is it Maya or Maya? Because I don't know how to pronounce it. But who are they? Where are they based? And perhaps most importantly, when were they around?
You start with that, because where I'm from, everybody just says Maya.
It's Maya. Yeah. No, it's not. Maya is not a valid English thing. It is sometimes said. I mean, I have heard people say that in England, but it's not. It's Maya. And they're also not Mayans. That's another mistake that you see often in print. The N on the end, Mayan, only refers to language.
Okay, so it's kind of, we just say the Maya.
The Maya, and... Okay. And even if you want to say you're talking about pyramids, you can't say Mayan pyramids, because that adjective only refers to language.
Okay.
And there are some academics who have a kind of detailed explanations and justifications of that it make you feel as if you're a horrible racist neo-colonialist if you say Mayan. I can't present that argument off the top of my head, but it's a pretty good one. So it's Maya, yes. And who were they? Well, okay, so that's before, I'm going to get sidetracked straight away and say it should be, who are they? And that's really the first, let's just jump straight in the deep end here. That's the first thing that's important about the Maya, is that they're not gone. I think that's sort of the first thing, and in a way, it's sort of where you end up with as well. It doesn't matter what conversation we're having, whether we're bashing Mel Gibson's Apocalypto or getting into kind of the nitty-gritty details of the books that Amara and I have written together. That, to my mind, is the absolute most important point, is the Maya still exist. So the Maya are a people, a civilization, and in a minute Amara will argue with the word, use of the word civilization, that's where we disagree. It goes back thousands and thousands of years. The area in which they live and have lived for thousands of years is Guatemala, Belize, southern Mexico, including the whole of the Yucatan Peninsula, and some parts of Honduras and El Salvador.
Which is a limestone shell.
It's a limestone shell, in case you're wondering about that. Any geographers out there?
But just to cement us in time a little bit, so the cultural traits that scholars defined as Maya, in quotes, we start to see those about 250. Okay, so he's saying thousands of years, and include, yes, we're into the second millennium, but there are people in the quote Maya geographical area before that, but they don't exhibit the level of, I hate this word too, but I'm going to use it, the level of cultural sophistication that we attribute to the Maya people. So there's
that's still thousands of years.
It is. It's technically, but I'm just trying to give some dates here that might be helpful.
I know this is a pretty smart.
They are sure. Yeah, definitely
smart. Or they got the wrong podcast. It's one or the other.
And when we say that the Maya are still alive, there are millions of Maya people still alive. I think we're at 27 distinct Mayan languages that are still being spoken. So this is a thriving community scattered throughout these countries that Matthew had just mentioned, and people that are involved in their own historical past, researching their historical past, you know, involved in kind of the cultural heritage part of what we would today call sustainability.
Can I just, before we move on then, why do you not agree with calling it a civilization?
I don't like the word civilization because it implies that other human beings are not civilized.
Okay.
And so I think it sets up a kind of
colonial saying that they weren't civilized. It's you saying that it just in general is a bad term.
Yeah. And so as soon as you say, they are a civilization, you start to set up this before and after. So the people who lived in what we call the Maya area before 250 weren't civilized. And I don't like that terminology.
Okay.
I thought you were going to say that you don't like it because it's a Western concept that applied in the period of European colonialism to judge whether non-Europeans were civilized or not.
That's the historical usage, but I agree with that. Yes,
I'm just giving you an argument here.
he's on your side.
I mean, I think sometimes with certain terms, they have baggage. And it's important to recognize that baggage and understand that civilization is a judgmental term, but it doesn't mean we have to toss it out completely. And I think particularly the reason why I like to use it with Amaya is because too often there is an assumption that they were sort of a civilization, right? Like anyone who's just seen Apocalypto would say these were people who were barbaric, they weren't civilized, or they were civilized, but it was a kind of satanic, messed up, fucked up kind of civilization, right? And so I think because there's that assumption out there that this is a people that were not fully civilized, and perhaps because of that, they no longer exist, right? So you're sort of battling against those two misconceptions. I think it's really important to kind of say, look, they were civilized. They are civilized. They're a civilization, just like you are, right? I understand that there's a judgment, but sometimes it's important to say, look, if you're going to be judgy, let's just put these people that we're talking about on this side of that judgment line. And so that you give up this notion that they were and are in some way inferior to you because of their culture.
Now, the one thing that we all know about the Maya is that they were really good at producing calendars. And that when the last one ran out in 2012, the whole world came to an end. There's something that might be wrong with that.
To be fair to them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've all seen 2012, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, I'm being facetious, but you two are the experts. So what's the truth actually behind all of that nonsense that you find on the internet about Nostradamus and the apocalypse and how we're not really here?
So I think the main thing to understand about Maya and then larger Mesoamerican timekeeping is that for the most part, they believed that time was cyclical. So not linear, although the Maya did maintain a linear calendrical system as well. But rather than seeing end times as the absolute destruction apocalypse of the world, most Mesoamerican civilizations, to use Matthew's term, thought that time, yes, the calendar will turn over, but that time will continually go on in these series of cycles. So there's no kind of anticipation that the world is going to come to an end, right? It will change, it will shift, but tomorrow will always be reborn. Do you want to talk about the Bakhtun and the real nitty gritty of 2012?
I mean, no, I was thinking this was a good on trend to us, like promoting our books. she's a real academic. She just wants to talk about, you know, the actual stuff itself.
I just want to make money.
Want to sell a few, because I mean that very short introductions book, that Maya book. What do we get, like 20p each on each book? Yeah,
like $12 maybe total.
That's how much it sells for.
No. I meant like total, like all the 20p.
That's right. Yeah.
Converted to American dollars is like $12.
We're making so much money for paying for gas station coffee.
We live in Pennsylvania, so we can go get like a cheesesteak or something. You know, that's about it.
All right. But in all seriousness, so we wrote a book in 2011 called 2012 and the End of the World, which, you know, it wasn't a bestseller. It did okay until the world failed to end. And then you'll be very amused to know that the sales literally just dropped through the floor. I think in January 2013, I think we sold 3 copies, which was surely someone who'd like left those books sitting in their basket on Amazon or something and forgot about them.
I think it was like hermits who came down off the mountain were like, what the hell happened? Why did this not work out? They really wanted to know.
So we've now rewritten that book. And so the book that just came out, we actually haven't seen a physical copy yet, but it did supposedly come out last week, called The Maya Apocalypse and Its Western Roots. That has been rewritten so it's not tagged just to 2012. And so what it does is, it answers a few really crucial questions that some people might have out there. You know, there's someone out there listening who can't sleep at night because they don't know the answer to these questions. And this is the book for them. So first of all, did the Maya predict that the world was going to end in 2012? Absolutely not. There is no evidence that they predicted the world was going to end in 2012, or that they had any kind of preoccupation with the apocalypse or with the world ending at any time. So if you're thinking, what if we just got the dates wrong? What if the prediction was right and we're just, it's actually 2021, not 2012, exact right? You've seen those memes. No, they did not predict that. So that's the first question, simple answer. Secondly, well, then why did people think they did? Which I think is a very interesting question. And that's what most of the book is about. It's about why people think they did. And there's a few chapters that talk about the roots of apocalyptic thinking in Europe and the Mediterranean going back, you know, a couple of thousand years, and how those ideas come to Mexico. And then we talk a little bit about the Aztecs and how those ideas then come to Maya peoples. But through the introduction of Christianity, right? And then the end of the book, which is the chapter that is most rewritten, which is the one I actually love the most right now, is all about why people believe these kinds of things generally. Why is it in the 21st century, in an era in which supposedly science has triumphed over religion, we all think in secular terms and so on, there's evidence that now more than at any point in human history, arguably, people believe things that are weird, it don't make any sense, are not evidence.
Read on Reddit, the cesspool of the internet.
Yeah, right, exactly. That I mean, actually, talking about people in Britain, they did some polls recently on whether you thought the world was going to end in your lifetime, and extraordinarily high percentages of people all over the world think that. And then of those people, what did you think was going to be the cause of the end of the world, or what was the apocalypse going to look like? The British chose zombies more than any other people in the world.
Oh, brilliant. I've already got zombies, a plan for if that happens.
I don't think they're having a laugh, right? No. I think they've watched The Walking Dead and Black Summer and shows like that. And they think, well, here we are in a pandemic. The next virus is just going to turn people into zombies. It's not that. I mean, it makes no sense, but it kind of does make sense, right?
Seeing as we're down this rabbit hole, why, just in general, why is society obsessed with the apocalypse and the end of everything we know? Because it's always been a thing, hasn't it? Everyone always thinks like they're living in the end times, or humanity is about to completely do itself in, and it is an obsession.
Yeah, I mean, that's what this book is really about. I mean, if I hate to do that sort of, you know, guest on a podcast thing, say, well, Alex,
if you buy the book,
the answer to your question is to read my book and make notes and then get back to me. There'll be a quiz. But that really is the idea of the book. Because at the end of the book, someone goes, okay, I get it. People are a bit nuts, but they also will understand it in a more sophisticated way than that. And it is to do with a cultural tradition that is in our civilization and has been for thousands of years. I mean, I think that's kind of one of the bumper sticker sort of arguments here, right? Is that people want to talk about the Maya and their calendars and their predictions for the end of the world. It's like, no, they didn't have that obsession. We do. Mm-hmm. And we are so obsessed with it that we tend to apply it, you know, to other civilizations. And now we live in a world where we have so much information that we can't possibly process. We can't possibly understand all it's. I mean, do you understand 5G technology?
No. I understand that I had the vaccine and I'm going to start talking Russian, right?
That's exactly right. I mean, and every year that goes by, there's something else that happens that makes this a pertinent topic. And I think not just the pandemic, but the, you know, the anti-vaxxer movement, that's something to try to understand, right? Like, what is that about? And that happened a little, you know, our book just came out. We didn't just write it yesterday, right? Obviously, it was sort of written last year. And so if I was finishing that chapter right now, I would do my best to kind of in a succinct way deal with
engage that
as not just like being version. Rude about anti-vaxxers, right? Because that's not the point is to understand that actually anti-vaccine mentality is deeply rooted in our civilization, and people had the same reaction to vaccines when they were first invented in the 18th century, right? We kind of know that now, but we probably, your listeners probably do. You probably did a podcast on that, didn't you?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, Alex is looking completely nonplussed.
Has this person been on? I'm like, dude, we're getting towards 550 episodes now. You can't expect me to keep them all in my head.
That's impossible.
Should we give the Maya people some more credit than just apocalypse crap then?
Absolutely. Zach.
Okay, so let's kind of set the screaming internet hysteria folks to one side. The culture of these people is interesting, and I mean the Maya, not the internet loons.
They, it's a whole other podcast.
It really is. They had pretty, I mean, I've always kind of thought this, the ability in terms of carving stone in particular is just staggering. I was looking at some of the work that you've done and some of the articles you've produced, and just the beauty of some of the really small pieces of jewelry and so on that they've got are just incredible in terms of the intricacy of the carvings. And you've got obviously those much bigger building projects that they're engaged with. And this is a society that's genuinely complex. So we're not going to fall into that kind of barbarism trap that was the focus of our discussions with Matthew last time. Before we start talking about their art, though, give us a flavour of how Maya society worked and their values culturally.
Okay, so it kind of depends what moment of Maya history we're talking about. I can talk about the classic period, which is the period of their history that I think most listeners are probably familiar with. Think gigantic, you know, sexy pyramids in the jungle that have supposedly been hidden for centuries, blah, blah, blah. Though that at that moment, so then I'm talking about between 250 and 1000, let's say, Maya society was essentially divided into dozens of what we would call kingdoms, for lack of a better term, but they weren't really kingdoms like we would think of them for, like, you know, Europe, medieval Europe. But instead, each kingdom, again in quotes, was led by a particular lineage group. And that lineage group had diplomatic relationships and economic relationships, or tribute relationships, with cities and towns and villages outside of the, what we would call the capital city. Okay, and so between these lineage groups, there were, again, dozens of them, all very powerful, there was fighting that happened, wars broke out, usually over arable land for various reasons. People were fighting, they have in all over the world and for all of human history. But as you were alluded to before, Zach, it was a highly stratified society, right? So you had this ruling elite at the top that was basically ruled by a person we would call the Ahau. I guess a good translation would, people say king sometimes, but again, that's kind of problematic. And then there was a whole bunch of lesser elites, what we call nobles, and these people all controlled a kind of state religion. Then there were various other kind of classes of people going downward from that. And at the very, very bottom, there's this massive, massive group of farmers, because all of those beautiful artworks you see in the architectural sophistication is only really possible if you have a society that is so stratified that you can have full-time specialists that don't have to worry about procuring their own food, right? And so all they are doing is creating those art, becoming professionals, as we would, full-time specialist professionals. So architects, stonemasons, artists, religious specialists, astronomers, probably poets. Maya life in this particular moment at the most elite levels was akin to European court life. There was a Maya court, right? And so all of that kind of pomp and circumstance and art being used as kind of these beauteous objects that proclaimed a ruler's power and authority, both in the political sphere, but also in the religious sphere and also in the economic sphere. All these things kind of tied together.
I like the word king as applied to the Maya. Like, it works really well. I honestly don't understand the, I mean, it's an English word and it has kind of conveys all kinds of assumptions, but most of them actually work with the Maya.
We have the indigenous term, so why not use the indigenous term?
Yeah, I know, but you can't. But if we just used indigenous terms, you know, on a podcast or in a lecture as a student.
We define it. I just don't want them to think about, you know,
they get
this like grizzly white guy wearing a crown and holding a scepter, you know, because there was like nuances of political and power systems in play. Women, for example, played a pretty prominent role in the Maya court. In some cases, at some moments in history.
We have queens in England.
I know, but okay, I teach in central Pennsylvania. When you say king, who do they think of? Actually, they can't even name an actual.
I don't know. King. I mean, in,
but they think of this very, very Eurocentric kind of political system. And I want to just get students away from that. All right,
fine. Has he just admitted defeat?
I'm pretty sure he just admitted defeat on that one.
I know. It does happen.
Yeah, Zach has slightly got obsessed with the idea of Maya Stonecraft. Is this, he's talking about how good it is. Is it like the Inca examples where they could have been done by laser and you can't even get a piece of paper in?
It's the energy is totally different between the Inca and the Maya situation. The Inca situation, they are very much interested in stoneworking as a building medium. So walls, right? And you get that perfect precision. Mm-hmm. With the Maya, the interest is in representation. So representation of deities, representation of usually of rulers. And I think it's really important that in the Maya example or the Mesoamerican example, it's a stone on stone based technology. So they are carving those stones with harder stones, which to my mind is just remarkable. In the Inca situation, they are better at metallurgy. And so they do have metal tools. They have like some kind of filers, and it's not huge metal tools, but there's a difference in terms of technology between the two groups. But yeah, the Maya example, I mean, how the heck do you do that with stone tools? It's amazing. I've been studying this literally my entire life, and I'm still amazed every time I walk into a Maya site that that was possible in 500.
Yeah, I think the Inca were like precision engineers and the Maya were incredibly accomplished artists.
Yeah.
And
all the Inca were too. I wouldn't say that they weren't.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of in Cuzco, that wall where literally the stones are so perfectly matched that you can't even get a sheet of A4 paper in between them.
Exactly. Like at Sacsayhuaman or even like the streets of Cuzco. Yeah, the Inca have a very different relationship to stone than the Maya do. Like the Inca have a kind of metaphysical relationship where they consider particular stones like genealogically related to them. The Maya don't have that same, what we'd call an art history of relationship to materiality. So for them, it's more about what is represented in the final artwork, as opposed to that level of engineering precision that the Inca have. So it's kind of a different.
They're much more functional instead of.
They're much more functional. And the other difference is that for the Inca, they're a huge empire. And so they develop stoneworking really as a kind of stamp of empire. And so when you think of Inca stoneworking, you have to kind of think of it as you do like Roman aqueducts, right? Wherever you see an aqueduct, that speaks to a kind of physical imperial presence.
Yeah.
For the Inca, that's the case. For the Maya, we don't have an empire. You'll see all the time, you know, the Mayan empire, blah, blah, blah. There was never any political
that whole sentence is wrong apart from the.
Yeah, we love that. That's great. That's an opening for us. Like, wait a minute.
Wait a minute. There was never an empire. Hold my bear. Always, always politically fractured. And in fact, I mean, Matthew knows way more about this than I do, but they don't.
Did you hear that?
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad this is being recorded.
Don't edit that out. That's at the beginning.
The Maya don't even consider themselves a cohesive ethnic group until the 20th century.
Late 20th century.
It's only scholars who consider this group culturally cohesive.
Yeah, the Pan-Maya movement evolves in the 20th century in Guatemala and in the face of persecution by national governments of the Maya. I mean, it's a whole other kind of story to their civilization. For that, you have to go to our Maya Very Short Introductions book. But the massive amounts of persecution that they faced in the 19th and 20th century. But let's not get into that right now unless you want to come back to that. But Alex, I thought it was interesting. You said, oh, you can go to Cusco and see those Inca stones. I think that's part of the problem of why the Maya are misunderstood, because if you go to Maya sites now, go to the ones that tourists can easily access, like Tikal in Guatemala or Chichen Itza in Yucatan, you cannot really see evidence of their artistic accomplishments, because what's left are stone buildings that have tumbled down and then been sort of put back together. But those buildings would have been covered in stucco. and then paint it. And so there's all this elaborate artwork and color and text, right? Because to my mind, one of the most amazing things about the Maya, and I think just this alone justifies why we should be interested in the Maya and, you know, sort of share this enthusiasm and interest with children and so on, is their writing system. Absolutely gorgeous. This is a writing system that does what Oz does just as efficiently. It communicates, conveys any kind of information you could possibly want to convey, but it does it in a way that is aesthetically, artistically splendid, varied. I mean, just astonishing. The Maya word, or at least the Yucatec Maya word for an artist or a painter, is the same as the word for a scribe or a writer. You know, we differentiate between those two things. Atzib. Atzib, it's the same thing. If you are an Atzib, that means you are somebody who paints or writes, because that's how artistic writing was. And those texts were visible all over Maya cities. I mean,
I've Googled it while you're talking, and it's incredible.
No, don't Google things while we're talking, because then you'll see all the things we're saying that are wrong.
Like our students, when we're in the middle of a lecture in class, like, I just saw on Wikipedia, it actually says this.
Yeah, let's have a no devices policy on History Hack, please.
But I think what Matthew's saying is absolutely right. The vision you get when you go into a classic Maya site today, or even post-classic, you're looking at the skeleton of a city. You know, you're not... Every pyramid covered in this like fondant of plaster, and then in some cases painted bright red. Like, that's a completely different visual experience than kind of the romanticized ruins, right, that you're supposed to interact with today. And as Matthew was saying as well, mural painting on some of those plastered surfaces, painted writing, right, there's a glyphs. If you think of Maya, glyphic writing is much like ancient Chinese calligraphy, right, where there were particular artists who were known for their handwriting styles, and they were coveted by these rulers of each city. And then also glyphs carved in stone, right? And probably emphasized using polychrome, multicolored paints. So
this is the thing as well, like Egyptian tombs were all painted, Greek statues were painted.
Everything was painted, not painted as boring, right? Yeah. Ancient people.
Not finished, like otherwise.
We like brightly colored, vivacious spaces. Yeah.
Humans, well, you don't like build a house and then leave it blank, do you? And they didn't either.
No, exactly. And so, you know, and we're finding more and more that these traditions that are developed in the early classic period, so around, you know, 250, they go all the way through the Spanish colonial period. And so there's this kind of level of cultural longevity that speaks to survivability in the face of conquest, right? So cultural heritage going through thousands of years during all of this like violent turmoil, disease, you know, military conquest, forced conversion to Catholicism. But ultimately there's this kind of root culture that remains not intact, right? It changes, but it's there. And it speaks to the strength of this cultural group.
I'm not sure we do like things to be all brightly.
Well, colored. Ancient peoples tend to. I mean, look at our house. Yes, we do.
But
who decorated the house?
Let's not get into arguing about that. I mean, we can, but
we all know if a man doesn't get prompted, all the women say magnolia or white, and there's no imagination. We know.
Oh, Nelson's column. He's not painted.
He
was boring.
Okay,
Maya.
When was that erected?
After the Battle of Trafalgar.
Okay, 1805.
So that is erected at the height of a European obsession with neoclassical aesthetics,
right,
which they misinterpreted as being white plain.
Right. Okay, that's actually a more sophisticated
version. Your people getting
it
wrong.
That's the point I was trying to make, but I didn't have the information. That's perfect. Okay, so thank you.
So hadn't gotten it wrong, and if there wasn't this European obsession with classical artwork as white, which is totally racist, by the way, it wouldn't have looked like that.
Okay, so what I'm saying is...
Can I just say, I was very tempted to kind of wade in on the whole Nelson Column thing, but was just waiting for Amara to turn around and educate Matt.
I'm an art historian,
she's
right?
An art historian, and so he's the
historian. So oftentimes the times when we usually fight about these things is when he oversteps what I consider to be a very strict disciplinary line.
Right. And she doesn't know about the Battle of Trafalgar.
Exactly.
She doesn't know what that
I kind of vaguely do, but right. My knowledge kind
was
of
at sea, by the way.
Yeah, I do
sea,
know that she, part.
Oh, okay. She knows a bit.
Yeah. My knowledge for most things stops at about 1700. That's it.
A few things have happened since then.
I hear that. Yeah, yeah. Apparently.
No, I think that the serious point I'm trying to make is that if your sense of what a public monument looks like is Nelson's Column, and now we know, thanks to Professor Solari here, why it's like that, and then you go visit Maya ruins, that makes sense to you. It's like, okay, you know, what it does is it closes off the possibility that you might say, but they're not, where's the paint? Mm-hmm. Where's the stucco? You're not going to ask that question, right?
Yeah, we just assume that the ancient past was somehow leached of color. The same thing, people think that the Maya weren't fun, like, or all ancient peoples weren't funny. Like, there's like ancient peoples are devoid of humor somehow. And any of us who work in Maya communities today know Maya peoples are hilarious. Mm-hmm. I mean, in Mayan language, like, everything can be a sexual pun, like literally everything. They're like taking a piss constantly with everybody in their villages. Mm-hmm. And yet as scholars and as the public, we tend to think it goes back to like the 2012 obsessions, that these ancient peoples were like so serious and always
sitting
into the world and were so religious and it's bullshit. I mean, it's bullshit. The Maya peoples were people just like us.
And there's a lot of humor in their art too.
Yeah.
Which, you know, was not apparent at first when Western scholars were trying to understand, you know, interpret this art. And the initial, assumptions made were like, oh, these particularly funny sculptures and figures and so on, this is bad things happening, right? These are people who are being tortured or there's certain kinds of evil gods. And they were going in that direction without thinking, well, maybe it's just supposed to be funny. Maybe these are jokes or references to jokes or references to funny stories and so on. And, you know, as Amara says, if you spend time in Maya communities today, they have this incredibly well-developed, sophisticated sense of humor, which for outsiders, you're tripping up all the time, right? Because I'd be like, just take a Maya guy and put him in a pub in London, right? First of all, everyone's making jokes all the time, right? And secondly, it's hard to explain the jokes and what the humor is and where it comes from, because it's kind of, I don't know, I guess I'm kind of implying that London pub culture has a sophisticated sense of humor. You might have a comment about that.
Well, it does if knob jokes are your thing. As is evidence on this podcast, which is largely Londoners making knob jokes. So. Do you want to come do the down the pub session with us? Because that's basically what it is for 3 hours.
Next time we're there, we'll do that one.
The Maya have lots of jokes.
Oh, yeah. And school.
I feel they would be perfect down the pub with us, Alex.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The Maya and Amara and Matthew.
The Maya
actually
would love rhyming slang.
Mm.
The ancient Maya would have loved rhyming
slang. Rhyming slang?
Yeah, they would have loved that. That was like right up a Maya alley.
They would have immediately understood the concept, right? And then they would have started like coming up with with the ones that made sense to their own kind of material culture. Mm-hmm. I think that kind of going back to the question that now I can't remember who asked it. I think it was Zach. It was this sort of really big, complicated question of the kind, you know, that you sometimes get in the classroom. You're like, it's like 7 minutes left.
I'm good at those really irritating questions that are stupidly broad and vague.
Yeah,
do
brilliant.
That all day.
No, brilliantly, I would say so. But going back to that question, I thought the challenge of answering a question like that is paradoxically to make the Maya relatable and understandable to us, and sort of to de-exoticize them, right? But at the same time, also not to make them out to be just kind of mundane and boring. I mean, we've been talking a lot about their art and their humor and all of those kinds of things, and how they did things that were in many ways similar to the way we do things, but also there are some things that they did really differently. And that's kind of part of what is intriguing and interesting to us. And so I think that's kind of the challenge, and where something like you know, I think you want us to talk about Apocalypto, or maybe you were just saying that as a joke, but something like that movie. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to give Mel Gibson any credit because I'll get into huge trouble, but I think he was in a way trying to do that. He just did it all wrong.
I would say there's in Apocalypto, the parts that I have my biggest peeves with are with anything that happens in the city, right? Because the movie kind of cuts between events in the city and events in village life, right? And I think he totally misinterprets the relationship between those two places. And I think he does an awful job of representing what life was like in one of these major classic period cities. But I did appreciate how village life was represented as being family-based, collegial, they're joking. I mean, he filmed the entire movie in Yucatec Mayan. Like that alone, so that students can hear that language, which is still spoken by a million people today, that was remarkable to do. So I thought as a kind of an artistic choice, that was wonderful. The city parts, I've had colleagues actually, it was Gerardo Aldana, Tracy Ardrin, wrote a rebuttal to Apocalypto when it first came out and called those scenes a hate crime against the Maya because they were so egregious in how they presented the Maya as bloodthirsty, violent, all these same kind of barbarous themes that Matthew covered in the last podcast. The sacrifice scene, for example, right? You just get this sense that Maya society at the most elite level is just people taking drugs, going into trances, and then capturing other people from the villages, painting them blue, and then hacking them to pieces, which is not what's happening at all in the city centers, right? Those, as I was explaining before, those are like city centers that are the kind of the epitome of the highest architectural and artistic feats. Are human sacrifices happening? Occasionally. I don't want to say that they never happened. They did happen. Historically, there's no way you can, right? There are some scholars who say they didn't happen ever, but I think most of us agree nowadays that they're happening on very prescribed ritual occasions, and certainly not in the tens of thousands or the dozens that movie portrays as having had happened.
Just see your colleague punching their keyboard. It'll be like when I did my Bridgerton rebuttal. Just like, and another thing that was shit.
I think it's a common thing, though, when Mel Gibson brings out a movie that he claims is historical, because we've got colleagues at Southampton who, when Passion of the Christ came out,
I was just going to
absolutely
mention,
lost their shit and wrote a...
We've had a Braveheart rebuttal on here, haven't we? About the fact that there were no kilts, no long swords, no face makeup, and pretty much the fact that it was set in Scotland was the only accurate thing there was.
Apocalypto, visually, there's a lot of homogenization that goes on between Aztec visual culture and Maya visual culture. And then that very last scene, do you know, when Jaguar Paw, the main protagonist, gets free and he makes his way to the coast and then he looks out on the ocean. Do you remember what he sees off of the ocean? He sees three Spanish ships with the cross of Santiago on their sails. And so historically what's happened there is Mel Gibson conflated, the pyramid scenes, if we're going to give them a historical moment, they date to the late classics. So we'll say 750. Okay. And obviously the Spaniards don't make it to Yucatan until, Yucatan's like they start in the 11, like 1511, I think is the first one. And then again,
shipwreck.
Yeah. But not three ships coming in, you know? So conflation of time and conflation of kind of cultural groups.
And worst of all, the idea, you walk out the movie theater thinking, oh, thank God.
Thank God for Christianity.
Yeah.
Thank God
Christian Europeans showed up to save them from their barbarism, and then everything's going to be okay. That guy's sort of being saved.
I honestly think that was the whole point of the movie. I mean, Mel Gibson, we know.
The entire point of Gallipoli was to make England look bad. The entire point of hang on, the Patriot was to make England look bad. The entire point of Braveheart was making. Yeah. I don't know why he suddenly left England alone and went for the Mire instead. He's always got an axe to grind, hasn't he?
There would
be an Englishman who would get shipwrecked on the coast of Yucatan and would teach them.
Give them all smallpox.
When are you ripping
out? All of them. Jason Isaacs washes up on a shipwreck.
Yeah,
with a mean, typical quintessential British bad guy, gives them all, like, I don't know, some classic period COVID and kills everyone.
We have a pitch. I think we have a pitch here. We should all fly to LA.
He will give us millions of dollars to make this happen. Should we end on then? Because obviously that's not what happened in the year 700 odd. Three Spanish ships didn't show up and save everyone. So the Maya aren't gone, but what accounts for the decline?
That's another one of these huge questions. Yeah. So I'll just say a combination of factors kind of coalesce in the 9th century to make that hierarchical society, particularly down in the southern area of the Maya world, not sustainable, just becomes unsustainable. Those factors are, we can just rattle them off together. There are environmental factors. So basically the land is being pushed beyond its own capabilities to provide food for increasingly large populations. The elite class has become very, very, very top heavy. The Maya, just like all other Mesoamericans, were a polygamous society. If you can afford, this is probably how most men think today, if you can afford extra wives, why not have them? So at the elite kind of level of society.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's why I'm trying to make more money with these books.
That's it.
Now the Bedouin still with it. Up to 4, I think. But only if you can afford it. If you can only afford one.
Very expensive to maintain more than one wife. Yeah. So all of these things are coming together that I think in the long run make people, I'm really simplifying this, but make people at the kind of bottom end of society, the farmers, really start to doubt the centralized authority of that ruling elite. And so slowly over the course of about 2 centuries, those big sites in what we call the southern lowlands become depopulated. It's not overnight. There's not a collapse that you hear about, right? It's very slow. But at the exact same moment, we start to see huge cities in the north come into their own. So cities like Chichen Itza, which a lot of people are familiar with, because if they go to Cancun, sometimes they will go to see Chichen Itza.
Day trip when you, with the hangover, I think.
Hangover, and usually, right? I've seen like a lot of people in bikinis and getting horrible sunburns there. Yeah. So Chichen Itza is coming into power right when the Maya are supposedly disappearing into the forests, right? So our whole narrative of what happens to Maya civilization, there you go, Matthew.
She folds eventually.
our whole narrative, the popular narrative that is problematic and doesn't kind of align with historical reality.
Yeah, the idea that the Maya civilization collapsed or the Maya declined or whatever, I think all of those terms are all wrong. This simply is not what happened. It's that there was certain cities and certain areas and were depopulated. In some cases, there was a war between city states, and a city state gets overrun and destroyed. And so the collapse happens in a year. In other cases, it's 100 years. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the Maya area as a whole, there's no collapse or decline at all. It's simply a movement of people and political centers and trade routes and so on. And that when the concept of the collapse was first became popular, it was because Mayanists, archaeologists, and other scholars kind of didn't understand enough about the chronological sequences of the rise and fall of city states in the Maya area. But it's a great idea, right? Like, oh, the Maya. And then also, climate change. So there's evidence that there was droughts, that there was, deforestation, overworking of agricultural areas and so on. So that seems to be a great moral, right? That people have picked up on that. Books that you know, sell very well, like you know, Jared Diamond's collapse, like, oh no, look, this is a moral lesson for us, look what happened to the Maya.
And that's what Apocalypto was. That I think that was the goal of Apocalypto. You're supposed to leave that film thinking, oh, look what happens when you have this overly sumptuous culture. It's a very Christianizing message, right?
Yeah.
And then at the end, you know, the Christians come, and the idea, as we were saying earlier, is that they're going to change this society so that it's not dependent upon this, I don't know, this kind of like hyperbolic level of consumption.
Yeah, and the reality is the opposite. And that's why it's so insidious. Because where do the Maya really, if they're going to decline, when do they decline and how do they decline? Not then. It's not the end of the classic period. It's when Europeans come and introduce diseases from the old world, and the Maya population literally is decimated. And we don't know the numbers for sure, but...
conservatively, 70%. But that's a conservative.
Or more.
No, like conservative.
Yes. It may be as possible as 90%. And then, so here are kingdoms sort of collapsing, becoming depopulated. And then some of them then get conquered and colonized by the Spanish. And so there's an enormous violence that is done, not just to the population, but also to the culture, right? So they no longer can build pyramids and temples and so on. They have to convert to Christianity. And on top of those pyramids, the Spaniards have them build churches and so on. Now, it's not all about what the Spaniards are making the Maya do. It's the story of conquest and colonization of the Maya is very complex, and local Maya elites often kind of collaborate in the colonial scheme in order to preserve their own positions of local power and so on. So it's easy to simplify, but what all of that does is then reinforce this idea that not only was this, you know, not really kind of a civilization, they were kind of barbarians, it needed to be saved, but that they had kind of gone into decline or collapsed or disappeared anyway, right? And so therefore it kind of doesn't matter what happens. And that's, yeah. That then is sort of doing violence to Maya civilization in the 21st century. Mayas are still there. They're still here. There are as many of them now as there were before that demographic collapse, right? So their population has recovered. Yes, it's recovered partly as a result of mixing with people of European and African descent. But nonetheless, they're as present as they ever have been, and more so than in many periods in the past. And their civilization has had to adapt, their culture has had to adapt as a result of the intrusion of the modern world. But it's the modern world, the early modern world, European colonialism, and the modern world that has really caused those changes to take place, right? And so I think that the kind of the decline collapse idea is sort of doubly wrong. It's wrong because it doesn't happen 1,000 years ago. And then it's wrong because it's a misdirect from what happens when peoples from the old world get there.
You need to know how you need to explain it to your students. It's that light bulb moment. It's not that from Jurassic Park, which is what I remember because it's my childhood, it that dinosaurs didn't go away, they turned into birds. Mind blown. They're still here.
I think there was a certain irony.
Well, I don't think Matthew meant to imply that the colonial period was a moment of collapse.
No.
Well, for the Maya culture. Because I would say while there were forced cultural changes, mm-hmm. that the Mayas were extremely, extremely savvy. And there was kind of a redirection or rechanneling of Maya interests in a kind of clothing of Catholicism. So for example—
Like adapt and survive, isn't it?
Oh, totally, completely. I mean, that's why they're still around. So within a generation of the Spaniards being in where we work in Yucatan, you see the same lineage heads, right, or their children, directing resources into building village churches that would have been put into building the pyramids in the pre-contact period. And you start to see a level of kind of community pride in what we read as Catholic architecture.
And they're building them in the same place.
Well, sometimes literally right on top of the pyramid. Sometimes they
using
have the pyramid.
Stones and everything.
and they take the pyramid down maybe 2/3.
Yeah.
And they use the finished stones from the top of the pyramid to build the church. Or they deconstruct a pyramid and then build the church right next to it.
See, I think, do you not think that that is that in a way, just a little bit of something, it's not positive, but it means that colonialism, despite its best endeavors, didn't quite manage to fuck everything up.
I totally agree. And I actually think on the level of the Maya community, it's a giant fuck you to the Spaniards.
Yeah. Yay for the Maya.
Because the buildings that are built in the colonial period, the artworks that the Maya are producing, they look European, right? And so somebody who's not really understanding the cultural nuances are going to understand those structures and understand those paintings of Jesus, of Mary, of whoever, as, you know, physical evidence of colonization and physical evidence of kind of a colonial imperial power, which I guess technically they are, but you have to understand and you have to really dig into what the Maya impressions of these objects are. And once you start to do that, like if you go into a Maya village today, which are still, you know, attending mass in the same church that their ancestors built in the 16th century, they're not looking at that thing like a stamp of their colonial past. They're not thinking of that building as oppressive. That's their community center. That's where they get married. That's where they raise their children and baptize their children. I'm not saying that colonization, in particular those early moments, was an awesome thing. I'm not trying to say Christianity is better than, you know, the polytheistic religions of the past. I'm just saying it's more complicated.
They built that church. Their ancestors have been in enjoying religious rituals in that exact spot. In that, not just on the village, but on the same side of the same village square. For thousands of years, there's the thousands of years.
And sometimes, in some cases, they are taking Catholic rituals and reformulating them as Maya rituals. And I'm not saying they're doing this kind of hidden from Friar's eyes or whatnot, but there's a way in which the culture that's created post-contact, post in the colonial period, is its own remarkably sophisticated and impressive third culture.
Yeah.
Right? A third culture that is not Spanish, because Mexican Catholicism does not look anything like Italian Catholicism or Spanish Catholicism. It's its own thing. It's its own thing because it has all of these influences from the indigenous peoples who helped produce it.
And so many years on, that's their history too.
Their history. And I think when we as scholars treat the pre-contact period as its own entity and the Europeans show up and then it's the colonial period, I think that does violence to the Maya community as well. Because if you're taking that stance, you're not admitting or acknowledging the level of implication and participation that the indigenous active participation that the indigenous population had in making their own society. Post-contact. I mean, suddenly their entire identity, their entire history is based upon when the Spaniards showed up. Like, that just seems like an insane way to define somebody else's history. It's not our history, you know, we're just trying to elucidate it.
There's also a certain irony, isn't there? We've been talking about the apocalypse at various points through this, and there's sort of this desire for an apocalyptic end to the Maya that just isn't there. Has been so, so good. You two, an incredible double act. This was better than I ever anticipated. Amara, Matt,
having us.
Thank you ever so much. This is, if this doesn't break download records, I'm going to be disappointed.
Well, it's a pleasure. You two are hilarious and always make it fun. And I'm going to have to find out what your best rated podcasters and go and do a lot of research on this so I can come back and talk about that subject. Bridgerton.
You will never, unfortunately, you will never beat the cast reunion for Band of Brothers. It's insane. they had 25 of them, some of them talking for the first time in 20 years.
Wow. Wow.
I had to edit in my life. But yeah, I think Eleni Yanagar talking about medieval dildos in her first appearance, women in medieval Q&A on women, where she inevitably, because she's a sex historian, started talking about her dildos again. Not her medieval dildos, but her research topic of. Unsurprisingly, that is the most downloaded non-famous person one we have. Wow.
So that's wonderful.
Yeah. So dildo, so that's what you're telling me. That's the key thing.
We know our audience.
I mean, the Maya had an incredibly well developed phallic culture. They put carved stone knobs, not doorknobs, on buildings. Yeah, seriously, there's some scholars who, you know.
There's an entire dissertation
on that. Yeah.
On Maya knobs.
That I would love
to. In public architecture.
Just think, if you want to connect, you know.
But I think what you're essentially saying to our listeners is listen to me because I can bring the knobs too.
Yeah, there's yes.
Excellent.
And on that moment. On that point.
thank you for having us.
Thank you.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.